Welcome to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films, every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific and online at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Because of some audio issues, I'm going to be introducing this interview. The interview itself with Alan Swire was conducted by my good friend Hobart Taylor, who is an expert in the field of blues and jazz. So it was an honor to have him come on and conduct this interview. While Houston may not come to most people's minds as a major music city like Memphis, Chicago, or New Orleans, it has a legacy that few other cities can match. Houston's early and indelible mark on American music and the blues, often overlooked despite its rich history, is celebrated in the soulful feature-length documentary film When Houston Had the Blues. We're joined today by the director, as well as our good friend conducting the interview, Hobart Taylor. The director's Alan Swire, and the film is called When Houston Had the Blues. Alan Swire, where did your life's work begin in terms of finding out and discovering and exploring the world of the blues and jazz and so much more?
I never discovered this kind of music. It was always there from day one. I grew up, my early years were spent in a black neighborhood. And that's the music that I heard. I heard it at friends' houses. My mother's kitchen was smoke. So whenever I had any money, I went to the soul food restaurant on the corner that had the best jukebox I've ever discovered. And the old man who ran it said, you know, somebody grumbled about the music. He said, if you don't like it, go someplace else.
What city was this in?
This was Newark, New Jersey.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, home of WBGO.
Absolutely.
What made you come to Houston and do a film about Houston?
Well, there's a young producer named Drew Barnett Hamilton, who's terrific. And she approached me and asked me if I'd ever heard of the El Dorado Ballroom. Did I think there was a movie in it? I said, I think there's a movie about Houston, a music scene that's never gotten its due, with the El Dorado being part of it. But the El Dorado is just anecdotal compared to the fact that there was Duke Peacock, that there was, you know, there were a million clubs, that it was a thriving music city that, as I said, largely went unrecognized. You know, people talk in terms of Memphis, New Orleans, understandably, but Houston had great, great music. Houston was a melting pot, which those cities weren't. It had everything. It had the French influence. It had the Delta blues influence. It had Tejano music. Name it. It was there. I said, you know, and she got excited when I told her more. When I told her she's from Houston, but like a lot of people, particularly white people, didn't know about that. Didn't know about Gatemouth Brown. Didn't know about Big Mama Thornton. Didn't know about Clifton Chenier living in Houston, et cetera, didn't know much about Duke Peacock, you know, Don Roby's empire, but we hit it off and we had a great time making the film.
So we're here with Alan Swire, and he is the director and the main force behind When Houston Had the Blues. I'm Hobart Taylor, and I'm not your regular host here on Film School Radio. I'm actually a jazz director at KUCI, which leads me to actually a couple of questions I have about the film itself. It talks a lot about the blues, but it talks about other black musics in Houston.
Absolutely.
I want to raise a question. Had you thought about, when you approached this, had you originally thought that you were going to cover the whole panoply of different types of music and musical styles? Because it seems like you've got four or five films.
Absolutely. I called it When Houston Had the Blues. I figured that was a very evocative title, but no, I didn't want to restrict it solely to the blues because, you know, the fact is that musicians can play everything, depending upon what kind of gig it is. Arnett Cobb, who's one of the people I feature in there, could certainly play the blues. He also is known for jazz. There's a kind of bluesiness to Arnett's playing, and that's true of all the Texas tenors. Remember, Don Wilkerson and David Fathead Newman, played jazz, but they also played for my friend Ray Charles. And that was not exclusively jazz. That was also blues and R&B, and when Ray felt like it, country as well.
I'd like to throw Eddie Cleanhead Benson in the mix. Yeah, there was definitely that, which leads me to my question about one of my very favorite musicians that you cover extensively, Gatemouth Brown.
Oh, wow. When Gate used to play at Antone's, he would pull out his fiddle at times, and Clifford Antone would start screaming, "Play the blues, God damn it, play the blues." But Gatemouth played, as you saw him say in the film, he played what he considered to be American music, Texas style, and didn't want labels attached to him. No, I'm not just a bluesman. I can play the blues, but watch me, I'll play all kinds of other things. He could go from gut bucket to highly sophisticated.
Ellington, he played a lot of Ellington.
Absolutely, he loved it, you know. And you know why? It's critics who put labels on musicians. And once upon a time, you and I remember record stores where they had categories. But in truth, people play all sorts of things. When it's time to get hired in a place like Houston or a place like New Orleans, once upon a time, you had to play what was called the book, everything.
How do you approach this? Did you because you've interviewed some, you know, fascinating people who don't get their due, particularly Trudy Lynn. So how did you approach finding some of these folks, and what was their attitude when you came around to do this?
People were thrilled. You know, people don't talk about legacy sufficiently. And a lot of people like Trudy are concerned about legacy. You know, she's still out there doing what she does, and it's great that she's doing it. But, you know, she feels that she gets her props in Europe, but not in this country. So she was excited. Jewel Brown, the late Jewel Brown, who sang for years with Louis Armstrong, she was thrilled. People opened, not only, you know, greeted us with open arms, but they helped us get to other people. My sense is, I don't believe in the term less is more. To me, more is more. When I make a film, I want it to be as comprehensive as possible. I also wanted to correct the fact that so many great artists have been overlooked. You know, Katie Webster, to me, was a monster talent. Again, you know, in Europe, she could fill an arena.
Yeah, I want to see a whole movie about her.
Oh, yeah. You know, but that's true of so many people. You know, and I wanted to show the breadth and depth of the Houston scene. Well, you know, somebody asked me about guitar players the other day, and he asked what I thought of Joe Bonamassa. And I said, Houston, once upon a time, had 10 guys who were better.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Mean,
aside from the stars, aside from Albert King or Albert Collins.
All right, so I'm going to interrupt you because let's go right to the heart of it. Cultural appropriation. You know, I mean, you're talking about one of the most famous cases of cultural appropriation in all music history, which is Hound Dog. And and Elvis is a success with that. And, you know, and there's the Otis Blackwell stuff. There's a long history of Elvis stealing. But the question is whether or not that is something that was different in Houston, because it seems like a lot of the white musicians you worked with were not like Joe B. They were actually people who had an appreciation for the music. You have a lot of you know, talk with I'm sorry, my mind is blank, the guy from ZZ Top,
Billy Gibbons.
Billy Gibbons, yeah, where he acknowledges the history.
Absolutely.
How's that different? Why is that different, do you think?
Well, Billy, first of all, is from Houston, grew up listening to that stuff. I mean, one of the reasons that Billy wanted to do the interview is that he knew I was going to ask him about Lightnin' Hopkins. To say that he's a Lightnin' Hopkins aficionado is to put it mildly. He worships Lightnin' Hopkins, so he's aware of the debt that he and so many other people owe to the Black musicians who really who mastered this craft, who pioneered this craft. I mean, you know, there are guys playing T-Bone Walker licks today that don't even realize that they're from T-Bone originally. For another film that I made, I interviewed Mike Stoller of Lieber and Stoller, who wrote Hound Dog. After we finished the interview, he suggested that I hang out with him for a while because we had a good time. And we started talking about Hound Dog. And I said, what do you think about the difference between the Big Mama version and the Elvis version? He said, tell me what you think. And I said, with Big Mama, aside from the fact that it's an astonishing record, it's also a metaphor. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, not, you know, coming around, right, expecting me to feed you and whatnot. He said, you know, it was a guy who's living off of the woman.
Yeah, it's a woman's song. Yeah.
And he said, what do you think about the Elvis? I said, it's about a dog. Woof, woof, woof. He said, you're right. He started laughing. It makes no sense. And it made me rich.
One of the things that we're talking about Lightning for a minute, that's sort of important about him and Freddie King, there's sui generis, right? A lot of the Texas artists have such a distinctive style, such an individual personality. You couldn't tell what the meter is of his music.
Absolutely.
You couldn't tell where it was going to go. Even lyrically, you couldn't tell, you know, there'd be switches, playing the bass with the thumb. The whole business of something that's so individual. How do you find, I guess what I'm getting at is that's really important to this music. How would you describe it or cover it?
Well, remember that those, you know, in the days of Lightning, there were all those clubs in Houston, and the audience was discerning. They didn't want carbon copies. They knew who did what. Tainer, you know, when you, the people who go to big arenas today, who go to Coachella or whatever, basically they know very little. You know, they just want to get stoned and groove. But, you know, when you have a knowledgeable public, which they had in Houston, they wanted everything to be an expression of the artist himself. Albert Collins was always Albert Collins. He was not trying to be copying licks from somebody else or trying to mimic somebody else. Lightning was an original. Lightning, you know, everything about Lightning, and it was an expression of his personality, his persona, and his art and craft. And the audience picked up on what he was doing. He could be a one-man band when necessary. He could play with other musicians, but he could also, you know, he could bang on the guitar, and that was the percussion aspect. That's not artistry, that's art. Real artist is an individual. Albert King was Albert King. Nobody knows, you know, how he tuned his guitar. Nobody knows, you know, but Albert King would blow you away. You know, and there's a reason that, you know, I included that bit of footage of Stevie Ray Vaughan playing with Albert King, because I wanted to show the public that appreciates Stevie Ray, who could play well, doesn't realize that Stevie Ray worshiped the guy he was playing with, Albert King.
Yeah, so much so that he produced those great records at the end.
Absolutely.
There's a couple of issues that people might not sort of be aware of. You talk a little bit about the effects of segregation and desegregation, and how, in a weird way, it was a detriment or in some way was deleterious to the growth and the development and the maintenance of the music. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Happy to do so. The fact is that, in my mind, the single most important social change in the 20th century was desegregation, was integration, which was crucial and needed to happen, and it's great that it did. However, there are always consequences that unexpected consequences. Suddenly, people didn't have to live within a certain area. They could move elsewhere. When they did, those who did were largely the people with money. They were the professionals, the professional class, because they could afford it. They were also among the most important role models in the family, in the community, rather. So they left. Businesses started to lose their allure. You know, we don't have to go to the black restaurant. We can now go to the white restaurant. We don't have to go to the black movie theater. We can now go to the white movie theater. Then two other things happened at the same time. Let's never overlook the aspect of Duke and Peacock Records. Don Roby was a source of employment for studio, not just for stars, for studio musicians, for songwriters, for restaurants, because he had a booking agency, for cab companies like your grandfather's. You know, he died. And then the city of Houston, wanting to become more modern, put in a freeway. Why did they choose the black section? Well, let's look at it. First of all, property values were lower. Secondly, there was far less political clout. And the consequence was they divided the Black community, the Black neighborhoods, in two. So the combination of those three things, and that made a huge difference. We can also add to it something else, and that was the advent of television, where suddenly people, this new thing, oh, we can stay home for free and watch instead of going out to the El Dorado Ballroom or to the wonderfully named Shady's Playhouse or the Club DeLisa or, you know, or all the, you know, the countless clubs that existed in Houston. So the consequence of all of that was that, and it happened in other cities too. Yeah. It didn't happen quite as dramatically because they didn't have Duke Peacock Records, but it happened elsewhere as well. And, you know, the Black community lost a lot of it, of its joy, and it went into what in many places and in Houston to some degree, a state of disrepair.
But the music didn't then, of course, in the 70s. I mean, the biggest star in American music came out of Destiny's Child, came out of Houston, right?
Right.
Beyonce. So, I mean, the music didn't end, but there's like a break. And what caused that, do you think, between all of the sort of pop people who came after Travis Scott? I don't care who you're talking about, big names, they're still coming out of Houston, but don't seem to have any connection with that other tradition.
Well, that's it. Lightning played in clubs in Houston all the time. Clifton Chenier played at dances in Houston all the time. Beyonce is playing in arenas and stadiums. It's a different world. Everything I've heard and read says that she still feels that she still feels Houston within her, but she's not there physically. She's not playing at clubs in Houston. She's not interacting. You know, you mentioned Trudy Lynn earlier. Trudy Lynn walking to school used to walk past a hotel where she'd get a peek at Bobby Blue Bland or somebody who was staying at the hotel. That sense of community is what's gone. So you still have great talent coming from Houston because there is a tradition, you know, but they don't remain Houston acts.
Right. So it's sort of like the old days in Harlem, when everybody was in one place.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, yeah. I mean, if you wanted to play jazz and you had a cabaret card, you could earn your living between Harlem and 52nd Street. You know, the move was I don't know if you're aware, there's a great bit. Sam Cooke was offered a gig at the Copacabana, which was at a certain point the place you wanted to play in New York. And he looked at the contract and he said, I don't want to play. Asked why, he said, look, if I play your place, I cannot play anywhere else for a lengthy period of time. That's part of the contract. It's a stipulation. He said, if I'm going to play in New York City, I'm happy to play at the Copa, but I also want to play for my people. And he was the first one to get the contract changed where he could play the Copa and then go play the Apollo.
Oh, that's big news. Yeah, that's a big deal. We're running a little low on time, but I want to make sure we talk about Grady Gaines and the Upsetters. Because, I mean, that's a piece of American history, music history, that a lot of people don't know. And I know all my, rock and roll Houston friends all were deeply influenced from Rock Romano, Dr. Rocket, staple on the scene in Houston. And they all talk about Grady Gaines being a major influence on them.
Well, Grady was a local star initially. And then Little Richard heard his band, the Upsetters, and said, they're who I want. So in the film, that iconic photo of Little Richard at the piano and the saxophone player on top of the piano, that's Grady, you know, from a film called Don't Knock the Rock. When Little Richard threw off his jewels at sea and said, I want to give up this kind of music. I don't want to play the devil's music. I want to play gospel. Grady and the guys went to work for another amazing star, Little Willie John. And then when Little Willie John went to prison, they went to work for a guy named Sam Cooke. Now, that's some trifecta. they were so, so good. But, you know, the vicissitudes and vagaries of the music business, the Upsetters were, to put it mildly, upset when they, you know, when Sam was killed and they lost three in a row. And ultimately, Grady wound up carrying luggage at the airport. Until there, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald said there are no second acts in American lives. Grady proved that there are. He wound up you know, Milton Hopkins, great, another great a member of the Upsetters, but another great Houston guitar player, convinced Grady to come back, and they reunited the Upsetters and wound up playing at Bill Clinton's inauguration, among other places.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. We're about to wrap it up, and I'm talking to Alan Swire, who is the director of When Houston Had the Blues, a documentary talking about the evolution of musics. I use a plural.
Great black music.
Right. Great black music in Houston. Jazz, blues, zydeco, and honky tonk, R&B, all of the musics. And I guess I'm going to end with this sort of deep question. There seems like there are a lot of films in here. And as I was watching it, I almost wanted to see like a series, like one of those PBS series. Anybody who's a film nut is familiar with the Les Blank films, you know, the Blues According to Lightning and you know, Well Spent Life and all the other individual films. You thought about maybe doing individual films about some of the people who don't have the recognition that maybe they...
Right now, I'm doing something a little bit more ambitious. I'm doing black music in L.A.
Oh, wow. Central Avenue.
I've never gotten its due. So, you know, we're talking about Louis Jordan. We're talking about Ray Charles. We're talking about Sam Cooke. We're talking about the great doo-wop from Dutone Records. Groups like the Penguins, Jesse Belvin. We're talking about jazz. Let's not forget the Dexter Gordon and Eric Dolphy. And right. Charles Mingus came out of L.A., 91-year-old Bobby Bradford is one of the people I interviewed. He was in Ornette Coleman's first band out here. If you don't mind, I'd love to mention that When Houston Had the Blues is now on iTunes. It's on Apple TV. It's on Amazon. It's on Tubi and most other streaming platforms. So it's out there for you to take a peek if you'd like. Tubi is free, so I'll push that one.
All right, great. Thank you so much. Is there any festival action going on?
We've already finished the festival circuit at the Houston International Film Festival. The film sold, it was at a multiplex. The film sold out in an hour, and they called and asked if I was comfortable with them adding a second theater. That sold out in just a couple of hours. And then they called and said, can we add a third? And I said, that'd be great. And they said, you're going to have to go from one to the other to the third. And introduce them. And I said, I'll bring a skateboard. Absolutely. What was great about that was that a lot of the people who are on screen were able, CJ Chenier came to the screening, Jewel Brown came to the screening, and others. And that was great. And in the case of Katie Webster, her family came. Then it played outdoors also. There was a summer series at Discovery Green. And we let them use the film for that. So yeah, it won best film in Amsterdam and best documentary in Paris. So we got our props on the festival circuit. Now we want to give everybody else a chance to see it.
Well, thank you so much again, Alan, and please come back when you have your next film done.
I would love to. Really a pleasure meeting you.
You've been listening to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films. You can find out more about the program at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Caspar. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week with another edition of Film School Radio.